Well, raised in Pasadena, California, Dr. Brooks Agnew spent most of his youth hanging around Caltech, the folks who co-opted at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. He entered the Air Force in 1973, where he became an electronics engineer, and after earning an honorable discharge, he attended Brigham Young in Western Kentucky and Tennessee Technological Universities. He's got a bachelor's degree in chemistry, master's in statistics, a PhD in physics, and he was a featured scientist in the 1997 Wendy Robbins documentary on HARP, Holes in Heaven. Currently a consultant to the manufacturing industry, Brooks Agnew, our guest on Coast to Coast. Hey, Brooks, how are you? Welcome back.
Oh, I'm doing so good, George. Great to be back.
This is going to be a fun discussion with you. I might even hold you an extra hour for some phone calls, because I understand you're going on a little expedition, aren't you?
Well, yes. In the summer of last year, I joined an expedition of individuals who were getting ready to go to the North Pole to explore to see if it was hollow or not, and I was on the team to build a gyroscope and do some headspace analysis of seawater, and fully prepared to contribute in that capacity. In August, I went up to James Gilliland's ranch up in Trout Lake, Washington.
Oh, yeah.
And I had an experience. I have never had an ET experience, never seen a UFO in my life, but that weekend, that conference changed me. I went there to speak, and I came away believing once and for all we're not alone in the universe, but something else happened.
I'm supposed to go up there myself, Brooks. I haven't planned it yet, but I've got to get up there. You know, I went to Portland and Seattle, and that's as close as I've been. I should have just spent an extra couple days. I've never seen a UFO, and they guarantee me that I'm going to see something that day.
Well, I don't know about the guarantee, but I know stimulus and response, and we did what's known as a CE5 protocol using lasers and intention, and we got two separate stimulus and response activities within about 3 minutes, which I recorded, and it was quite amazing.
Now, you know, we have had on this program over the last several months a couple of guests who've talked about the hollow earth theory, the pros, the cons. What's your take on this, Brooks?
Well, it's interesting. I have read a lot of books. I've listened to a lot of conjecture. And as an engineer and a scientist, I went through all the textbooks and all the writings and found out that no one had actually been there. Everybody was just sort of speculating or using their imagination or using existing geological information. And so I decided to join the expedition to do some serious science, to see if real measurements could be made, to see if the Earth is made the way they think it's made.
Now, what kind of technology is going to be going out that way on this expedition?
Well, that's interesting. Of course, there are three things that we're really looking for. We're looking for an impression or a depression in the sea. That is to say, the ocean isn't round all the way around the planet. There are places where gravity is low. For some reason. We don't know why. We don't know if the crust is thin or if it's a magnetic anomaly, but tankers and shipping companies that frequent these areas talk about a depression in the ocean. They can feel it, but it's very difficult to see because you really don't have enough perspective on the ocean. You only can see about 8 or 10 miles because of the circumference, the curvature of the Earth. So, and GPS units don't really work that high very well for altitude. They work fine for two-dimensional measurements or for navigation for aircraft, but not so well for sea level measurements. And you really can't go by the ocean floor because the ocean floor may contour as well, and the ocean's about 4,200 meters deep at that point. So it's going to take some special instruments to be able to detect this depression, and we're going to try and measure it for the first time, and that's going to be a very important discovery, geologically speaking. And the second is that if there is an inner Earth opening, then the seawater going in and out of that opening is going to have some different properties, different salinity, different marine life, different pH. We're going to try to measure all that as well. We'll be tracking it as we go into this area, which by historians have been determined to be, And I'm talking about going all the way back to the year 1400, coming forward with, you know, great scientists like Edmund Halley and others, that this is where the location is. So we're going to take measurements, and if we don't find anything, it's still going to make a great expedition, a great documentary. But if we do find something, well, that's going to change everything.
Well, you know, the late Admiral Richard Byrd apparently went into the hollow earth and came out with some incredible stories. And we'll talk about that in a second, Brooks. But let's go back to those 1400s, that period. What did some people say about these possibilities?
Well, that's a good question. The builders of Roslyn Chapel in Roslyn, Scotland.
Yes.
I went there a couple summers ago, spent 5 or 6 hours in there taking photographs. And when I was going back to the photographs, I looked up in one of the ceiling shots that I had, and there was a very ornate carving came down right over the altar in the front of the chapel. I had to actually lay on my back on the altar to take the shot. And there it was, right in the middle of the screen, a hollow earth with an inner sun. And this was built in 1442. Then we go to Egypt, and there are plenty of records of an alternate or higher dimensional aspect to the inner earth. And then there are legends in Shasta of a city called Telos underneath that mountain and others. And of course, many channelers, which I kind of take that stuff with a grain of salt. I'm not saying that it's not happening, but as a scientist, I have to really go hard data if I can get it.
Well, now Byrd talked about some incredible things. He claimed that his plane was basically met by a flying craft, that they safely brought him down, that he met leaders of the Hollow Earth. It's an incredible story. I mean, absolutely startling. Do you believe, if it exists, Brooke, do you believe that our government or governments on this planet are fully aware of this?
Well, I facetiously say that, you know, if our government has discovered that there is an opening and another society or another civilization, another ecology in the center of our earth, I'm sure that they would disclose it to the public. Of course, I say that tongue-in-cheek.
Yeah, exactly.
In February of last year, the government issued what's called the Data Denial Act, and it applies to the polar satellites that go over the north and south poles of our globe. They have restricted the real-time data from the EUMETSAT, METCOP, of the METOP satellites. They will not release any photographic data from above or the 60th parallels in the north or south of the Earth. So basically all we have is a center shot just for weather purposes only of our planet. We don't have any publicly available photos of the North Pole.
How will you know if you're in it? I mean, it's got that kind of circumference movement to it. I mean, you go right into it. You won't even know it, like Byrd flew into it.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think with an aircraft, there is a possibility of flying into this, especially he was flying at very low altitude relative to today's aircraft.
True, yeah.
We don't fly much below 10,000 feet when we're going up there. Byrd was flying at about 2,500 feet sometimes. And it would have been possible, just what we call IFR, I fly roads, to fly along the circumference of the Earth and fly into a hole. Now, it's also reported by many that if there is a society that lives in there, that they protect that hole, that they actually have a way of masking it with a mirage.
Well, how big do you think the opening is?
Well, a couple of our historians say it could be as small as 80 miles across or as large as 500 miles across.
How do you mask something like that, Brooks?
Well, when you're flying at 30 or 40,000 feet over it, or as our satellites do, about 240 miles, it's pretty easy to mask. Not many aircraft fly low altitude over that area. Now, we do have some photographs from some ice-based expeditions that happened several years ago, and they were scheduled to traverse this area where we're getting ready to go, but they stopped about 6 miles short because they saw a mountain range, and they decided that the mountain range would have been too treacherous that the ice in front of it might have been full of caverns, and so they turned around and came back. We have ground photographs of these men standing with the mountain range in the background. The problem is there's no mountain range there. It doesn't exist, but it sure shows up in the photographs.
Maybe in maybe like a hologram or something like that?
Well, that's what we're thinking.
Yeah. Well, that would be an interesting way to mask it, wouldn't it?
Yeah. In any case, the data doesn't seem to back up the theory of the present idea that we float on tectonic plates on top of a pool of magma around a solid core. Our magnetosphere doesn't support it. The mass of our Earth relative to our diameter doesn't support it. The orbit around our sun doesn't support it. And some of the marine life data that we have doesn't support it. There's a species of seagulls that only exist in the Arctic area, but they don't migrate south in the winter. They fly north.
Do you think there's a light and heat source if indeed there is a hollow Earth?
Well, it would have to be. Now, the inner core, some people have said there's an inner sun in there. I don't want to use the word sun too loosely. We're not talking about a fusion sun like we have in the center of our solar system. But any body that would give off visible light and not going down into the UV range like fusion would, but somewhere in the IR range or high visible range would give off a nice soft glow, would certainly promote photosynthesis and provide enough heat for an ecology down there.
Now, when we're talking about this hollow Earth, the possibilities of this, are you talking about it in the physical, three-dimensional sense, or are we talking about something else?
Well, that's a good question, too. It is pretty clear that explorers like Byrd and others that were featured in works like The Smoky God made a third-dimensional trip, that they did not raise their consciousness or change the phase of their craft or anything like that. They just flew on in. Maybe they were admitted somehow. But then there is the idea, especially purported by the Egyptians and the Mayans, that there is a higher dimensional, a fourth or even fifth-dimensional component to the interior of the Earth, and that third-dimensional beings just can't behold it. We also see this in the UFO community. Real, legitimate UFO sightings don't have an exit for the craft. The craft just simply blinks out of view. It just phases
out
of view.
That's right. That's true. All right, Brooks, stay with us, because when we come back, I want to talk about the science with your investigation, but then we're going to talk about some real interesting things as well, like these UFOs that reportedly have been coming in and out of what could be a hollow Earth. Who do you think is in there? And what do they look like? We'll be back. The science of this, if it exists, Brooks, what do you expect to find? Different kinds of vegetation? Admiral Byrd saw, you know, the woolly mammoths and things like that. What do you think's in there?
Well, now you're accessing the little boy in me. You know, this has been such an exciting project to be involved with. To go to the North Pole, for one thing, is just going to be phenomenally exciting. But when you think about, okay, what's going to happen if you really do find an opening? What is the plan? How are you going to get there? What are you going to do? Well, here we're utilizing the only ship on the face of the Earth that's rated for passengers that we can travel on. It's a 450-foot-long, 23,000-ton nuclear-powered Russian icebreaker.
Jeez.
Yeah, 75,000 horsepower. It's the only craft that's rated for civilian travel that has enough fuel supply to go where we want to go. Well, in speaking with the expedition company, the shipping company, they don't want to take this ship into the opening. So the plan is, we're going to put together a team of 100. We have 33 scientists. We're taking 30 exopolitical people, many of them world-renowned. We're taking three separate film crews, visible light, IR light, and even UV, and we're going to shoot this documentary. And what we plan to do is to get the boat near where this opening might be, and I'm going to tell you a little story about how we're going to determine that.
Sure.
And then we're going to wait and see if we can get, and I know this is a very strange experimental condition, but we're going to try to get the consciousness of this boat to a high enough level that if there is an intelligent component that lives in the interior of the Earth, they will come out and meet us. And when they do, we're going to get it on film.
That's incredible. You imagine that? If this happens?
Well, I try to, but I'm really trying to be the expedition leader and not the expedition fanatic. I'll tell you a little story. When I went to James's, I wasn't even thinking about the inner Earth. I was thinking about speaking up there at the Earth Transformation Conference last summer. And my third night there, we were practicing meditation each night. I was meditating and facing Mount Adams, which is renowned for its spiritual component. And all of a sudden, this, well, for lack of a better word, a conduit opened up between the mountain and me. And I checked myself over, made sure my heart wasn't beating faster, my leg wasn't moving or any of that. None of that was happening. This was an external force, like a puff of air repeating on my chest. While this was going on, I'm hearing these sounds like singing, and I hear these words like peace and love and joy, and I think, wow, I'm really having a neat metaphysical experience. And then it ended about 15 minutes later, and the people that were meditating behind me had their eyes opened for some reason, and they said, wow, did you see that? I said, see what? They said, you had all these kinds of charts and graphs and schematics and gold that were appearing on your back and disappearing into your body. So it appears that I got some kind of download when I was up there. Now, that was Saturday. When I came home on Monday, I checked my email and found out that the current expedition leader had suddenly died. So I called the second-in-command, Rodney Clough, who I think has been on your program
yes.
before, and I said, Rodney, what are we going to do? He said, well, I guess we're done. We can't go, and the expedition leader's...
It's over, yeah.
Yeah, he's expired. So I'll have to refund everybody's money, and we'll quit. And I said, Rodney, I don't quit. You know, there's only two kinds of engineers in the world. They're starters and they're finishers, and I'm a finisher. So he said, well, how would you like to lead us? I said, well, hold an election and see what happens. Well, they unanimously elected me to be the expedition leader. So then I was talking to another friend of mine who I think you probably know, Angelica Whitecliff.
Yes.
And I said, Angelica, what does all this mean? And she's very intuitive, a star child, brilliant lady. And she says, you know, here's what's going to happen in my opinion. You're going to get up there about 5 or 6 days into this 13-day expedition, and the captain of the ship is going to turn to you and say, well, we've run the course, Dr. Agnew. Where do we go now? And you're going to know.
In the 1950s, Brooks, Fate magazine issued one of their monthlies that said that UFOs were coming out of the hollow Earth like crazy. Remember that?
Yes. Not that I was alive in 1950, but I do remember that article.
When were you born?
I was born in 55.
Well, you were alive in the 50s then.
Well,
you were just too small to read a magazine. That's
too
it.
Small.
Unless you
couldn't read until 1959.
Junior engineer who knew what he was doing at 9 years old then, or four or something like that. Now, We've had a past guest on. I'm going to try to get him back on again. He's been sick, but his name's Red Elk.
Uh-huh.
And he believes that there are reptoids, not humans, but reptoids living in the hollow Earth. Have you heard that?
What I have heard is that there are at least 8 major races and as many as 200 minor races living in the interior of the Earth. Some of them are off-worlders, and some of them are ancient civilizations that have lived here long before we got here. And they do travel in craft. Some of them can leave the planet. Some of them cannot. They just travel around the planet observing things. And it appears that recently, like since the mid-1940s, the activities of we, the surface dwellers, have been quite perturbing to those who live in the inner Earth, namely nuclear weapons testing and pollution and electromagnetic pollution, among just a few. And we're doing terrible things to the sea, which happens to be common between the inner Earth and the surface dwellers. And so they are now, more than ever, coming to the surface and interacting with people who live on the surface. Some of them are trying to help, and some of them are actually maybe not involved in our best interests.
I'm going to try to get Pat Boone to go with you.
Yeah,
you know, he was in that movie, Journey to the Center of the Earth. It's only fitting.
We're going to try to get the best that we can find. We're trying to get the Taylor boys that wrote A Land of No Horizon. We're trying to get, of course, Michael Sollett to come, and James Gilliland and others that are fairly familiar with this, along with our historians. And it's, you know, we can take 100, and we have about 68 seats spoken for right now. And it promises to be something right out of X-Files, I think.
Are you, and I've got to ask you this, you're bringing weapons?
I don't plan to bring any weapons. I don't think we're going to need any. If there are any on the ship, then the Russians will have them. And that's going to be a challenge, too. This craft has a 150-man Russian crew. We're going to have to get their consciousness up to that level.
Do they know what they're doing? Do they know where they're going and why?
Yep, they know where they're going and they know why. And some of the crew are quite excited about it. Some of them have issued statements to us that they have sailed close to this area where we're planning on going, and they have seen strange lights in the sky, strange lights under the sea, and they're pretty convinced that there is a major activity point, a portal, as it were, in that area.
Well, now, let me ask you, if there's that 80-mile to 500-mile hole at the top, what about the possibilities of smaller openings all over the planet that all connect to the same center of the hollow Earth?
Well, as part of our exploratory efforts, I have gone to Mount Shasta. I've been to Mammoth Cave. We are going to Egypt later on this fall. We're going to try to go to all of these places if we can and hook up with whoever is supposed to be the authority on where this opening is, and we're going to try to gather all the information we can. This is a real serious expedition, although for my colleagues, I often repeat that it's for entertainment purposes only.
Well, why do you do that? Sounds like a scientific quest, doesn't it?
Well, I have to say, in the last, three or four years, the notion of peer review or publish or perish in the physics community has begun to loosen a little bit. Prior to, I'm going to say, maybe 1999 or 1998, if you were to try to do anything like this, you would have just been lambasted and not be able to publish anything. But the evidence that when we go up against things like seismological data from the USGS, it begins to get a real serious scientific component to it. When you look at the data that's been collected since these accelerometers have been placed around the globe, and they've been upgrading them year in and year out, they're getting better at measuring earthquakes, at predicting earthquakes, and then we sort of do an MRI of the Earth every time there's an earthquake. If there's an earthquake on the other side of the globe, the vibrations go through the planet, and they're picked up by accelerometers on the other side of the planet, and we kind of map the interior of the Earth. The trouble is, when you look at the data, the technicians draw in these dotted lines to an area called a shadow zone. And now, I don't really like dotted lines when I'm looking at data. I want to see, where did it come from, where did it go? Well, there's another scientist whose name is Jan Lambrecht, and he took the data and worked it backwards to the point of earthquake, and guess what it shows?
Why?
It shows a hollow Earth. It shows a crust of somewhere between 800 and 900 miles thick, an open air area between maybe 1,000 and 1,200 miles, and then a dense solid metal core that might even be glowing. And the counter rotation of the core and the crust is what creates our powerful magnetosphere. Not all the planets in our solar system have one.
Now, we know that there have been scientists up there at the North Pole. Has anybody leaked any information, Brooks, that would give you any idea that that hole is indeed there?
Well, now, the scientists are located pretty much at the North Pole. They have ocean floor probes that they recover every few months down around 4,300 meters. Mm-hmm. They're a little tricky to find and get up off the bottom, but they sit down there and do data logging. But they are about 500 miles away from where we are planning to go. 5 years ago, you could not have made this expedition. The ice would have prohibited you from getting there. But because of global warming and some massive ice shelf repositioning, this area is now accessible by sea.
This is an amazing journey, Brooks.
Well, I think it's going to be great. I'm looking forward to braving 120-foot seas and below-zero winds. And
what if you get there? What if you're successful, like Bird was, and you don't come back because they don't let you come back?
They, meaning the inner Earth people?
Yes,
or they,
the inner Earth.
You know, people. It probably won't break my heart a bit.
What do you mean it won't break your heart? You mean if they capture you and keep you there and enslave you?
Oh, I don't think they're going to enslave me. I just don't get that feeling at all, George. I don't. I'm an explorer. I've got to go.
Well, I don't know about that. You know, the conquistadors, they had their hands full. They didn't expect that.
Well, we're not going to conquer or take anything home. We're going to learn. We're going to reintroduce ourselves to them. And if you look back in the ancient record, even in the book of Isaiah, it says, that in the last days, or in the turn of the age, it says, between the age of Pisces and the age of Aquarius, which we're getting very close to, and in our second book, The Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, we talk about this in great detail. There's supposed to be a highway of ice open up in the north, and actually the lost 10 tribes are going to be reintroduced to us. This may be the very component that fulfills that prophecy.
So you're mixing, by the way, a little supernatural with a little real science.
Well, sure. We take in all the data that we can. It's one of the most perturbing things that I see in the scientific community is they regularly throw out perfectly good data just because it doesn't match their model.
Once again, Brooks, just give me all the possibilities of what you think the inner Earth could look like.
It could have an ocean similar to the ocean we have with its own marine life, but there's not going to be any day or night. And whereas we have an atmosphere that we fly above with our space shuttle somewhere around 230 miles or fly an aircraft somewhere around 8 or 10 miles or breathable atmosphere somewhere around 3 miles, we're talking an atmosphere with perhaps 750 miles of breathable atmosphere. That will change the ecology, the look, the totality of life on the interior of the Earth. And we're talking an ocean with no horizon, no stars, no nighttime, a complete and also a third less gravity than we have here on the surface. It would be hugely different than what we see here.
What about vegetation? Would that be different?
Yes, I think so. The wavelengths of light that we're looking at in the visible range, somewhere, I'd say between 900 nanometers and about 450 nanometers, would be conducive to giantism in plants. And if there's that kind of protein level, there's no reason to throw out the idea that there would be giantism in animals as well.
What about dinosaurs?
I think dinosaurs, yes. There would be no extinction event that we know of that would have occurred there. And there are literally thousands and thousands of mammoths that have been found somewhere around 80 miles in the ice in a circumference around this area that we're talking about going. Many ancient records and even some modern records suggest that the mammoths actually wander out of the center of the Earth when there's an ice shelf. They get out about 80 miles and literally starve to death and freeze right there, and that's where their bones are found.
These entities that may be residing in the hollow Earth, were they always there, or did they migrate there? Some kind of calamity may have occurred on the planet on the surface, and they all went there somehow?
Interesting question. Astrologically, or astronomically, we talk about how planets are formed, although we haven't really witnessed it because, well, we just don't have enough lifespan to watch it, so we speculate backwards. Where dust coagulates out of an accretion disk and forms a solid ball, and then that kind of revolves around the sun, and voila, you have a solar system. Although our solar system seems to indicate far more a higher level of order than that. The gravity models don't seem to match that up. Planets don't form as solid balls. They actually form as spheres. And if you look in the book of Genesis, you see very clean, clear language of the creation of a planet by dividing waters from waters, upper waters from lower waters. In other words, forming a crust in a water planet so that you have water on the inside and water on the outside, and then light is created on the inside. A lot of people don't know this, but when you look at the Genesis creation, it doesn't get a sun and a moon until the fourth day.
Well,
but it still has light.
Or the fourth time period, whatever that might be.
Right, whatever that is, right.
We have a past guest, Brooks, who has disappeared, and I want you to know this. I'm going to heed the warning. His name was Dallas Townsend, or Thompson, and he went into the Hollow Earth. He said he was going on a mission. Nobody can find him anymore. He's gone.
Funny you should say that. We had two members of our expeditionary team leave for the South Pole 3 months ago. We haven't heard from them since.
Should you have by now?
I think so, yes. They were supposed to communicate with us on a regular basis.
All right, stay with us. We're going to open up the phone lines when we come back, Brooks. We're keeping you for another hour. A lot of people are fascinated by what you're going to be doing, where you're going to be going. But, yes, definitely heed the warning. Don't do what has happened to Dallas because nobody can find him. I don't know if he made the mission or not. Who knows what happened to him? I want you to at least be able to come back and report to us exactly what you've seen. I'm George Norrie. I'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. If you need to email me, that's very easy. That's george@coast2coastam.com. Brooks, how long is your expedition supposed to last?
It's planned to go 13 days, so it takes about 3.5 days to get there. It's a little bit of a logistical challenge. We have to get people from New York to Murmansk, Russia. We have to make sure everybody that joins our expedition is, you know, properly cleared to get there and get all of our equipment there. Some of the equipment we cannot get in the United States. For instance, the gyroscope. I went to Honeywell, which I've purchased, well, undisclosed millions of dollars worth of equipment from Honeywell over the years, and they would not sell me one, nor would they tell me who has bought one, because that instrument's used also for aiming of weaponry.
Uh-huh.
So we're gonna try to get our hands on that that gyroscope in Russia instead.
Okay, assuming you get into the Hollow Earth, how far down are you going to go?
Well, that's a really good question. If the crust is in fact 800 or 900 miles thick at its thickest area, it is reported to thin there at the poles, and that's why this oceanic depression occurs, because gravity does not center in the core, it centers in the crust. So if there's less gravity, there's less force pulling the water to that specific area and more force pulling it away, and so the ocean kind of thins out right there. I'm saying if we're going to wait for the craft or crafts to come up from the inner Earth. And part of our questionnaire, if people go to phoenixsciencefoundation.org and click on the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition link, there's a questionnaire there, and we are collecting those right now. We will sift those down to about 200 applicants, and then as we get closer, we'll narrow that down to 100. Part of that questionnaire is, are you willing to step off that craft onto another craft to go the next step?
Let's go back to the calls now. First time caller line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, how you doing?
We're fine, thanks. Go ahead.
Recently, I guess it was a couple days ago, they found the colossal squid, and they got some pictures of that.
This is the one that had its own light system, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And the size of this thing, they got the photos of it, and within a couple hours, it died.
Right. It's not used to living at the surface. And if you'll remember, about 3 or 4 weeks ago, there was a very strange shark that was captured as well.
Right, right. Do you think that due to the fact that there's a gravitational difference, that there's a possibility that this creature could have come into, you know, our ocean system, and the difference in gravity was what could have possibly been its demise?
No question about it. Either gravity, there's a difference in magnetism, there's an exposure of radiation from a sun that they're not used to, not to mention the amount of pollution in our ocean.
Let's go to our wild card line. You're on Coast to Coast with Brooks Agnew. Hello there.
Hello, this is Casey calling from Tennessee.
Sure.
It's great to speak with you guys. Dr. Agnew, I have a question for you. Will you have means on your expedition of remaining in constant contact, possibly through some sort of satellite communications, or maybe be able to provide a webcast in real time for people that are interested in being a part in any way they could possibly become a part of it?
Great minds think alike. We actually have three of the most talented satellite uplink people you can imagine. And we will be streaming live from the craft, and not only will we be streaming live video, we're going to be streaming the data to three remote servers in undisclosed locations around the world, so that in case something does happen to the ship, or we get boarded, or all of our documents get captured as we get back to port, all that data is going to be safe and sound in an undisclosed location.
Brooks, any relation to the late Vice President Spiro Agnew?
Actually, he's not an Agnew. He was Greek. His father's name was something like Agapopoulos.
Oh, they
That's
changed
pretty close.
Yeah.
And he changed his name, so Spiro is not of the Agnew clan. The Agnew clan goes back to the year 695. That's as far back as I've traced it. They were the hereditary sheriffs of Galloway in central Scotland, and they were also the guardians of the region round about Rosslyn Chapel, and the Agnew clan and the Ross clan were vassals and intermarried with each other over the centuries. And as luck would have it, I don't know if bloodlines have anything to do with this or not, I am one of the last heirs of the Ross Agnew marriages.
Oh, really? That is interesting. What does that mean to you?
Well, I think that the Ross clan, which became very involved with the Sinclairs as they moved into the area, and the Agnews, which were the land magistrates and the knights that protected the area from plunder, they were heavily involved in Freemasonry, and that goes way, way back. And so it seems that that maybe there is some preparation for a few generations to put the right genes in the right place at the right time. History is known to do that from time to time.
West of the Rockies, you're up with us. Good morning.
Good morning, George. First of all, George, I just want to let you know that my son and I went to the conference last August in Trout Lake. Why Coast to Coast does not do a remote from there, I do not know why. We saw craft two out of the three nights that we were there, so you really got to get down there.
Got to get my engineers to let me know if they can hook those broadcast lines in there.
You bet.
Yeah.
Brooks,
I broadcasted live from the podium at James's Ranch, so I know it can be done.
ISDN lines?
Pardon me?
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Oh, yeah, Brooks, hi, buddy. You know, I was there to witness your speech after what had happened to you, and it was such an emotional speech. You could tell that something drastic had happened to you, a change, because I think that you were like a hard science guy and you just kind of got kind of turned around. Besides the graphs that appeared on your back and whatnot, did you also, if I remember correctly, didn't you have a telepathic thought that you were on the right track, that you were doing the right thing and don't give up?
You you remember that, and as do I. And I'll tell you, I don't speak about this much publicly, and you don't get much more public than Coast to Coast. Yes, I had, gosh, this is so difficult to put into words for me because I can't do it in accurate language. Yes, it was an extremely emotional experience, and the reassurance that I got from the voices that I heard was so, it was so filled with love. That's the only thing I can tell you, just an overwhelming feeling of love, so much so that the last 6 months, or last 5 months since August, I have enrolled in three classes, workshops in meditation and higher understanding so that I can understand what happened to me. And I've done my best to try to assimilate that knowledge and understand what it is I'm supposed to do with this information.
You have got to be excited, Brooks, about this trip.
Well, I am, and experience teaches me, you know, not to get overzealous, to be careful. There's a lot of there are a lot of people relying on me to make sure that all of the pieces get into place and this expedition actually happens. It is a difficult thing to do. If I tell people, look, I cannot go to the moon. It's just not there for me, and I doubt we'll get to Mars in my lifetime. But I can go to the North Pole. This I can do.
Now, they may make Mars in your lifetime. That's possible.
Well, I'm looking for that 2024 moon trip. If it's at all possible, I want to be on it.
I'm beginning to think we might get to Mars before we even get back to the moon. Wild Card Line, you're on the air with us. Hi there.
Hey, George. How you doing? Joe from Boston.
Sure, Joe.
I wanted
Hi.
To thank you for your book. And I wanted to ask you, Doctor, a question, if I could. It's too
sure.
bad that Steve Curry died. You said the expedition leader. And Dallas Townsend, I guess, is, I don't know whether he's a newsman, but would
no, Thompson.
You...
Thompson, this is...
Oh, Thompson. Well, I haven't Thompson. Heard from him. Would you be able to help sponsor some of us? I asked Rodney Clough, and I talked to him a while ago. He wasn't able to at that time. People like myself, who especially are visually impaired, because if there is a hollow earth, and I know people think I'm crazy, Rodney, I've talked to him, and he has said there's supposed to be almost no sickness in advances. He was supposed to go into... to the inter-earth, get permission. If I could contact you by email, I would love to go on the ship and bring my tape recorder because it's a once-in-a-lifetime thing. I mean, if there isn't, it'd still be a nice trip. But people say I'm crazy. Even though it sounds outright landish, it's always good to be open-minded, and I'd like your take on it. And, George, when are you coming up to Boston?
I got to get up to Boston pretty soon.
Yeah, I got to meet you, and I want you to put your hand on my throat and heal my throat. I have a throat problem. I'm serious.
There are no guarantees here.
I know.
So. All right.
Doctor, can you answer my question?
Sure. All you have to do to get a hold of us, of course, is to go to phoenixsciencefoundation.org. There is a questionnaire underneath the Advanced Planetary Explorations link. If you can get somebody to fill that out in your words and just send it to us, it's a real easy questionnaire, not anything difficult.
Is it an email questionnaire? Is it on? Because I can do it possibly by email. I have a screen
here. Yes, it's an email questionnaire. It'll go to applicant@phoenixsciencefoundation.org. We've collected a few hundred of them now.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the people have excellent stories to tell and great preparation, both spiritually and scientifically. And some don't, but we're going to try and be as fair as we can possibly be and make it open to everyone. And if it's successful enough, we may do it 2 years in a row.
But my question is, would you be able to help sponsor people get some of the funds to go? Because it is an expensive trip, and sometimes they can't. Rodney wanted to, but he wasn't able to get...
Well, now, here's the difference. The previous leadership, they were actually selling seats on the boat. We're not going to do that because, in my opinion... A boat full of rich tourists is not going to get us where we need to be.
That's what,
trust me, scientists and exopolitical leaders have not the money to do this kind of thing. We barely have two quarters to rub together. So we're getting the film industry, the major networks, to put up the funds to conduct the expedition.
Okay.
That's where the funds are going to come from, and we've had a lot of great interest, and we're narrowing it down.
If they accepted me, would arrangements be made so I could come? I'd have to get a passport and stuff. Would arrangements be made?
You'd have to get a passport, and you'd have to meet, you know, whatever health regulations that you need to get out of the country and get back in. But there would be no cost to anyone who comes on the expedition, with the exception of getting yourself to New York City.
Well, that's no problem. Well, I will send you an email, and I'd like to contact you. You seem like a nice man, although I don't understand the metaphysical thing, and spiritual things haven't worked for me, but you never know. And, George, thanks a bunch for taking my call,
okay,
Doctor.
Joe. Good luck.
God bless. Thanks for the call.
Appreciate it. The science behind this, you know, we've talked a little bit about the supernatural part of all of this, but the science behind this, how advanced, if you get there and you find beings, entities, how advanced do you think they are?
Well, chances are that their civilizations haven't undergone cataclysms like we surface dwellers have. So the contiguous advancement of technology has probably occurred. If you remember, in the not-too-distant past of us surface dwellers, the Church wouldn't even look through Galileo's eyepiece to discover if the Earth revolved around the Sun or not. So we've had some major roadblocks in the way of us advancing technologically here on the surface. My understanding is they don't have those kinds of roadblocks in the inner Earth community, and they do have the ability to travel in ways that we do not. Anti-gravitational drives, plasma drives, and even trans-dimensional drives, which we're just dreaming about right now, maybe.
Brooks, what if they don't want anything to do with us, with these surface dwellers?
I think that's been the case. I think they've sequestered themselves away from us. They've been very secretive. They've been protective. But the understanding that I have from many, many sources around the world, from Germany, Hawaii, of course, Washington State, and even the Eastern bloc, is that the inner Earth is nearing a point of greeting. They're ready to make contact. And this may be the expedition. It's the only civilian expedition in known history. They may be ready to make contact.
Maybe. Wildcard Line, you're up with us. Hi there.
Hi.
Yeah.
George. This is Mike from Livermore, California.
Hi, Mike.
Listen, doctor, I find this fascinating, but if I'm to understand you right, that there's a crust and then it goes to a hollow shell?
Well, this is what the data seems to lean toward. Now, we're not trying to say that we know what hollow earth theory is definitively, but we know at least as much about it as we do the tectonic theory, which is the current theory taught in geology classes now.
Well,
the point is that there's enough room for question, so we're just going to go and see.
Well, that my question would be then is that how are volcanoes formed?
Well,
the
crust is over 800 miles thick. We've only drilled about 3 miles into it. We know nothing about it. We know that the magma exists, but even if there were 200 miles of molten lava, which could surely account for all the volcanoes that we have, it doesn't extend all the way to the core.
Well, I understand that, but how are you going to get through the magma? I mean, the way with the tectonic plate theory, you have the tectonic plates submission underneath the other plates, the continental plates, which create the volcanoes. They go down, they heat up, and then they come back up as magma.
Actually, there's almost no geological data or proof that that actually happens. The subversion theory, where continental plates are sliding underneath other plates and that's creating the pressure, nobody's witnessed that. It's almost an engineering impossibility for crust to suspend itself out over an open void like that and push itself underneath another body. Tectonic plate theory has a lot of holes in it. What seems to have a little more credence is that the crust is actually expanding, and it's cracking apart and filling in with molten material from underneath. There's data to back up.
But the molten material, then, is there a layer of molten material? And if so, how does the opening into the center get past the layer of molten material?
Well, obviously, you can't go through the thickest parts of the crust through a molten mantle. We just don't have a drill capable of doing that. You've got to go to areas where the crust is thinned or where there's a cool opening. The two known areas like that would be the two poles.
So the mantle then wouldn't be a complete sphere like on the inner surface of the crust?
Correct. It would look a little like the navel of an orange. If you go to phoenixsciencefoundation.org, there are a couple of pictures. One is a satellite photograph, and the other is a drawing that's been done. And you'll maybe have your curiosity piqued.
And any chance of this expedition, when you come back, being on like History or Discovery or something like that?
Yes, there is a chance of that. Now, both of those organizations, neither one of those organizations take unsolicited projects. So you have to go through a producer, and that's what we're screening right now, our producers.
Okay. Well, if you need some help there, we know some people also, Brooks. So you
absolutely will accept that.
You just get a hold of Tommy, our producer here, and he's got a whole list of people that we've worked with in the past.
This is a sizable expedition. This is about a $2 million expedition, not the normal little $100,000 expeditions they are used to.
They're used to funding those quick little projects, yeah.
Right, right. But this, you know, you're probably talking a 5 or 6 day series. I was sitting with a producer in Hollywood back in November, and the special Everest was on, and he was commenting about the photography and how well it was shot and all that. And I said, Stuart, how many times can you climb Mount Everest? It's been done about 50,000 times.
Yep.
This has never been done.
So accurate. Brooks, we'll be back. We'll take final calls on Coast to Coast AM. Assuming you don't find other inhabitants there, Brooks, how will you know that you are indeed in the Hollow Earth?
Well, that's a good question. The Yamal, which is the nuclear-powered icebreaker the Russians operate, has a smaller boat on it, and it also has a helicopter on it. So we plan to use these other two vehicles for some triangulation and some forward scouting to make sure that we don't get off track. So that is one way of knowing. The other is, of course, our seawater analysis. We believe that if the ocean is passing through the crust into the inner crust, that it is going to have some pH differences, some marine life differences, maybe even water composition differences, and we're going to be able to track those and record those. And we're also going to be doing side-scan sonar. We'll be dragging that behind the boat, doing it at various depths so we can get different resolutions. But, you know, if we're pinging the bottom of this ocean and we come to an area that just goes away, it's just a big hole, that's going to be interesting.
Sure is. Let's go back to the phones. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Hello there.
Hi, this is Tana from Oklahoma.
Hi, Tana.
Hi, I have a quick question for you, and I'll hang up.
Sure.
Years ago, Art Bell did a show on, I believe it was called Mel's Hole.
Yes, he did.
Where the scientist dug into the earth and put a microphone in there and taped what he heard.
No,
and it sounded like hell.
Okay, hold on. That was another totally separate issue. So Mel's Hole was one where a fellow by the name of Mel Waters,
mm-hmm.
who owned the land where this hole was,
mm-hmm.
He apparently sold it. And nobody knows where he is anymore. But then there's that other episode where some Soviets at the time, apparently it could be one of those myths too, but drilled a hole and then put a microphone down and you heard those sounds of hell, as we call it, right?
Yeah. So I just wondered what he thought in relation to all this.
Well, that's a good question.
Okay.
One of our team groups is Major Ed Dames. And
oh, really?
Team,
okay.
Yes. And a team of remote viewers, and these are the best remote viewers in the world. Now, they've already done a preliminary viewing of the magnetic North Pole. Now, this is about 1,200 miles away from where we're going. But they did get an impression of incredible evil at this point.
Oh, really?
Yes, they did. And one of the advisors, one of my close friends, Brent Miller, said, you don't want to go there.
Well, that's why I've asked you, how do you know where you're going? You may get into the wrong spot.
Well, we're not going to leave any stone unturned. Between this remote viewing team, our two historians, satellite data, chemical data, and the side-scan sonar, we're going to get about as close as any expedition has ever gotten.
Better bring something, holy water, crucifix, you never know.
I think we're just going to bring good music and great intentions, and we're going to try to raise the consciousness of this ship to a level that you normally see in a workshop, except nobody gets to go home for 13 days.
Wildcard Line, you're up. Hi there.
Hello.
Yeah.
Hey, how you doing? This is Rico. How you doing, George?
Good,
and
Rico.
Mr. Brooks, how you doing? I have three questions, and I want to take the answers off the air. The first question is the Earth, if that is the hollow Earth in relation to anything to having to do with the Garden of Eden? And the second question is, the Edmund Halley's prediction of hollow Earth in relation to the aurora, or I guess the northern lights, have anything, or did it ever get any attention back in those days? And the third is really simple. Do the tsunamis and earthquake have anything to do with, like, I would say an underground civilization moving stuff around down there?
Okay, let's go with the third one first, and I've written the questions down for you, Bruce.
All right. Well, the third one was the tsunamis. It is quite possible. We have what's known as errant waves. These are waves that are not caused by earthquakes. They're not caused by any kind of winds or sudden anomalies or volcanic eruptions. But some of these waves get on upwards of 90 feet in the open ocean, where the ocean is deep. And the shipping companies really don't know what causes them.
Next question had to do with the Northern Lights.
Yes, that is a very good question. We do, with the SOHO satellites and with other satellites, we look at the aurora borealis as it occurs, a solar wind. I check the the space weather every single day. And the theory is that the solar wind strikes the Earth with fairly high energy and creates charged oxygen particles, which is the visible component that you see from the ground. All that makes wonderful sense if you're talking about an aurora borealis that occurs on only one side of the planet, the windward side of the planet, as it were. But what would cause an aurora borealis at both poles at the same time? And what would cause an aurora borealis when there is no significant solar wind? When we look at film of this aurora borealis occurring, or the northern lights occurring, it looks like it starts in the center and works its way out. And it starts at the lower altitudes and works its way up. It very well could be high-speed ions coming out of the center of the Earth on a magnetic flux.
And Garden of Eden.
One of our historians, Rodney Clough, believes that the Garden of Eden is, in fact, in the inner Earth. He often ends his emails, "next year in Eden," to me. The other is a little more open-minded. I am serving as the uniter of the clans, so I don't really have an opinion on it. If it's Eden, I don't really care if I come back to Western Kentucky or not.
You know, you said you've got Dr. Ed Dames doing some work for you. Of course, you know, Dr. Doom would probably find evil at an ice cream festival.
That's true. But his team is renowned, and they have won lotteries and untold dollars in Las Vegas using their skills.
Let's go east of the Rockies. You're up with us. Good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Doctor, I had a comment first, and then I have a question. The comment is that you're aware they found humanoid bodies 3 miles below the surface here as they went down. I heard that about a year ago, and I figured I've always thought there were people or somewhat humans in our inner Earth. Now, you mentioned Ed Dames remote viewing the magnetic North Pole.
Mm-hmm.
And you're aware that our magnetic field is moving, and you can prove it out by the wobbling of the Earth.
It is moving, no doubt about that.
It's not north is north is north anymore.
Yes, that's true. The North Pole, actual magnetic north, wobbles between 50 and 100 meters on a pretty regular basis, even
right.
During the day.
I can prove that out myself with a compass, you know, putting it on a flat piece of paper for those people out there that want to prove it out, and point the cursor to north, and then make a mark and where it's pointing, and then every 2-3 days check it.
Well,
and let it go for 30 days.
We have pretty fine magnetic satellites going around the globe now, and we get a fairly good
updated picture of the magnetic field around the Earth, and it does move kind of like an amoeba.
Right.
But this is indicative of a harmonic or a modulation between the core and the crust, which does support the theory.
Doctor, you believe that the wobble of the Earth going around the sun is tipping the Arctic closer to the sun. Meanwhile, we're gaining the gamma, X-ray, and ultraviolet, and various rays, and causing havoc with this inner of our Earth. And it's like so much like putting liquid in a rubber ball and not filling liquid up and just rolling the ball, and it wobbles all over the place. And it could be happening below our surface.
That happens to be one of the things we just don't have enough time perspective to make decent predictions. We do look at the rock, especially in the Norwegian area, that has a broad spectrum of magnetism, but this could be spread over millions of years. I don't expect to see, unless there's a polar shift or some kind of major external gravitational event, to see the crust of the Earth realign with respect to the sun in 100 lifetimes.
All right, thank you. Wildcard Line, you're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
I'm Lois calling from Kansas, and I had a question. If you find this opening and you go in and explore, and I know you touched on this before about not being able to get back, and you said something about, would the research end then? Or are there other brilliant people like you folks ready to go right away and carry on?
Yes, to both of those
right
questions.
Away, or is it going to take years? And is there another ship? I know you said there's one ship.
There's only one ship, civilian ship on the Earth capable of making this trip. So if we do this, we would have to do repeated trips, either in the same year or multiple years. But we are not going to take this ship into the opening. We are going to put ourselves in proximity to it and wait to see what happens.
I see.
Well, and if nothing happens, you leave?
Well, when the 13 days is up, we come back. Now, if we...
So why don't you go in, if you are indeed there?
Well, because I don't think we can risk the assets of something that we're just chartering. If we,
they've got to have insurance, don't they?
Yeah, I reckon they do.
Yeah, Lloyd's of London paying the insurance on a ship that got lost in the hollow Earth. That'll be a first.
Well, it's sort of like going all the way to the moon and just going around it a few times and then coming back.
If you're that close and you think you're there, you're going to have to go in.
I know. But we are really trying to map out some strict parameters to this experiment, and we're going to try to collect all the data that we can. We may have some latitude, depending on funding, to make changes in route, maybe have an option to extend, that we just move an escrow account and stay another week. I just don't know. We're going to have to play that part by ear. Right now it's 13 days, and we're going to try to go late this fall.
First-time caller, you're up with us on Coast to Coast.
Hi, George. Hi, Brooks. This is Lauren from Santa Monica.
Right up the street. Go ahead, Lauren.
Yeah, I'm actually traveling north on the 15 to Pahrump to hit up Area 51 as well. But,
all right. Enjoy
it. Yeah, this is a great trip. Anyways, my question has to deal with what kind of information you might be transmitting via light to them, given that, getting outside of the paradigm where we're trying to, come up with spacecraft that go at the speed of light or greater. Instead, I'm thinking that we already travel at the speed of light by using data transmission, and some civilizations might even be more advanced to, decode the human genome if we send it in a laser, or even if we can somehow code consciousness and the human genome and send that with a laser, maybe they'd be able to intercept that somehow and create a physical corporeal entity out of the information that you guys are transmitting. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that light speed is far too slow to make any kind of traverse across space. But human consciousness, now that's something completely different. According to physics, the definition of space, as opposed to void, is an area that contains energy or particles. Human consciousness is energy. So if we are projecting our consciousness from one point to another, you are actually in the process of creating space. And there is an entanglement between the energies of that area and the energies of the person that's actually doing the intention. That entanglement allows that information, that data, that creation to occur instantaneously, far, far faster than the speed of light.
Okay, good. Hope that helps you. Wild card line, we'll get one more in. You're on Coast to Coast. Hello?
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, Michael.
Yep. I just want to know, have they ever seen an invisible entity, and have they dealt with them?
Have they ever seen an invisible entity?
Ah. Well, you know, it's very interesting. We take camera crews wherever we go. I was at the Conscious Life Expo this last week, and I made a presentation on the North Pole Inner Earth Expedition, and there was a photographer in the back taking shots as I was speaking. At the end, he came up to me and showed me his digital shots, and there were these, we'll just call them orbs, all over the room. It seems as though there are entities that make themselves invisible to the range that these instruments, especially digital cameras, can pick them up with or without a flash. Our eyes, maybe it's our brains that tune it out, but our eyes aren't really sensitive enough in that wavelength of light. But these instruments are. I have seen IR cameras, invisible cameras, strapped together and used to film the sky. When people thought there was a UFO there, the visible camera didn't see a thing, and the infrared camera clearly saw a UFO.
Well, Brooks, as we say, sayonara for your appearance tonight. I trust
you. It's only been a few minutes.
I trust you'll be able to come back, huh?
Oh, absolutely.
Exactly now, when's the trip?
Well, exactly, it was the end of July. We are in some logistical problems right now, trying to work things out with the producers. We thought we had that nailed down. We got preempted by another show, so we're trying to put that back together. Maybe Tommy can be a good help to us on that.
Okay, so so the trip is as of right now?
No, the trip is going to be late,
right?
This fall, August, possibly September. That's our window.
What is your window? You've got to go then by when?
We have to go by November. Otherwise, we're going to be in 24-hour darkness. Some of our team wants to go when there's 18 hours of darkness. Some wants to go when there's 18 hours of light. It just depends on what the photography team wants to do. I prefer about 50-50, but it's so warm up there even now. The icebreaker would be perfectly at home.
Are you scared at all?
Fear? No, I don't live my life out of fear at all. I'm an explorer. I'm ready to go.
Same with me. No fear. You must be excited then.
I am excited.
What do you think you'll see?
My goodness. I'm just a little 8-year-old boy right now. I'm standing and I'm walking around my living room talking to you on the phone. I think we're going to see another world. We're going to see a planet that's never been seen before.
Cities.
Never been seen before.
Spaceships.
Yes.
Civilizations.
You know, if that side-scan sonar crosses the bow of a 200-foot saucer sitting on the bottom of the ocean and it moves, we're going to get it on film. And if it comes up out of that water, 250 people are going to see it, and there will be cameras snapping in every wavelength you can think of. And everything is going to change. What is going to start it out to be a fun trip to the North Pole could be the greatest geological expedition in the history of the world.
Can you do updates for us from the ship?
Yes, absolutely. Live updates, you bet.
We'll do that. Count on it. Thanks, Bruce.
Great.
I'll be
Thank
back
you,
in
George.
A moment. We've got 2 hours now of our Friday into Saturday morning open line.